It is 7 o'clock. Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. A couple of housekeeping items. Yay, I like seeing the hands waving. That's awesome. We'll only be recovering and recording and publishing the audio portion of this meeting. You can also sign up for an email, a low volume email on our website at simpleactions.net. I usually get that ready before the meeting, but I didn't do it. So I'm going to throw that out there right about now. So there's a link to our website, and then the seven tradition links are also there. We'll talk more about that when the time comes. So that's it for housekeeping. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Anybody new tonight? Feel free to unmute and say hello.
My name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic and I am new and glad to be here.
All right, Scott, welcome. And Melissa, will you read the preamble?
It would be my pleasure. Hey everyone, my name's Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. And this is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you so much. All right, the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step 4, part 2. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Jen Y and Scott. So I will start off the reading. And hey, Jen, we usually do ladies' choice around here. So after I'm done reading, you can either go first or throw Scott under the bus as you see fit. So let's see, let me get my screen life together here. So far, this meeting is running like a well-oiled machine. All right, we're going to start off. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. On page 67, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and his wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Jen?
Thanks, David. I'm going to go ahead and kick it off. I actually have a thought in my brain and I don't want to lose it. So hi, family. I'm an alcoholic and my name is Jennifer Yox. My sobriety date is January 2nd of 2014. And I'm from Richmond, Virginia. My home group is here. My sponsor is here. And I'm grateful to be here with y'all. So, this just diving right in at the fear part is always a little weird for me, because leading up to this point, there's just so much, there's so much behind this. And I know for me, when I got, when I was getting sober, one of my biggest fears was looking at fear. I was afraid of looking at all of the things I was afraid of, because I knew there was a lot of it. I didn't know how much. I knew there was a lot of it, and I was really not interested in seeing how much fear was actually running my life. And I'm really grateful for the support of other people in the fellowship and for a sponsor who was willing to just be really patient with me, to learn, for me to get to the point that I could say, this is another thing about myself that I'm going to have to learn to be as honest as I can and maintain the rigorous level of honesty that I need to stay sober. Because if I can't figure out how to be honest about me with me, I have no chance of learning how to be honest with all of you. And the way fear has been broken down really simply for me is that just all of the fears I have are driven by a want. And then that want, like, just drives the fear all over myself. And when I'm in fear, I do wacky stuff. Like, I make really wacky choices when fear is driving the bus. And so my sponsor has a really simple question that she has me ask myself, to say that if I trusted and relied on my higher power, what would I do and what would I not do? And that helps move me out of fear. So I'm going to toss it over to Scott now for this one.
Thanks, Jen. Scott?
Hi, everyone. My name is Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I wanted to mention just quickly that when I first came to AA a couple of years ago, I spent about the first year in fear of the fourth step. And I think that may be common with a lot of other folks, because I hear about this a lot. I was fine with everything about AA just from a cursory glance until I got to step four, because I thought, and I hear this a bunch, I thought I had to go through and make a list of all the dirty, nasty things that I had done to everybody and kind of dwell in it. And Jen mentioned this too. I was fearful of dealing with my fear, if that makes any sense. And I was so verklempt or just kind of wrought up by all of the emotions around that I couldn't get things done. Now, what does that tell me about fear? Is that's pretty natural for fear when we are afraid of things and when I'm afraid of things and I don't address them head on, I'm pretty useless. I'm useless to be able to help people. I'm useless to fellow alcoholics. I'm useless to a lot of things. And it's like so many things in AA, once we identify what the problem is, and for me, it can be wallowing in fear where I just cannot move forward, then we can find a solution. And oftentimes the solution is actually listing out what it is that I'm afraid of and how does it affect me and what can I do about it? The other thing that I want to mention about, I think what finally got me through going through not only resentments, fears, and then also, sex and harms done to others, was realizing that Bill did a really good job of saying in the book exactly how to do this inventory. My sponsor, thank God, walked me through doing an investigation about just what in the world did he really mean when he wrote this chapter. It's definitely written in kind of 1940s business language, but we read it through and through, and we figured out that if I go through, this is what I was really afraid of, and I'll close with this. I was afraid of having to identify so many different details about everything that I've been scared of. And basically, I was going about it the wrong way, because in the kind of diagram that Bill gives, he says in there somewhere, we made a list of the fears that we have. I don't know if we've gotten to that point or later, and I may be pulling that in from another part of the area. But if I list first all the things that I'm scared of, that's pretty easy. And then if I kind of keep going through, you know, what am I afraid of? How does it affect me? And all the different other things that I need to analyze, it's a lot easier to do it down the list and over to the right, if that makes any sense at all. And I certainly hope it does.
Awesome. All right. Thank you both. We're going to continue on page 68. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Jen?
I'm gonna let Scott go first on this one.
Thank you, Jen. You know, the thing for me, and what this, if I boil this, I think these two paragraphs, or maybe one paragraph down, is that if I do all of this stuff by myself, I will continue to fear it. I'll continue to be scared of it. This is the real difference in AA is, you know, early on in the steps, we determined that somehow there was something outside of ourselves that could solve our problem. And for me, that's the same thing with fear. And that does have to do with faith. And I have to wrestle with the word faith in this context, because for me, and this is strictly for me, this is not faith in capital G-O-D God. This is faith in a power outside of myself that can solve my fears. And I have to be really careful about that and really emphasize the God as we understand him, or God as we understand God. Because sometimes my context of God is much more spiritual. It's much more ethereal than it is sort of the religious nature of that. But I do know this. I know that as I inventoried my fears and did it with somebody else and talked with my sponsor about this inventory, because we know doing an inventory is really hard by ourselves. In fact, if you've ever done an inventory in a store, you don't do it by yourself. You usually have people that somebody is writing it down, the other person's counting it. It just makes sense to do it with somebody else. And the same thing goes with relying on the spiritual aspect of this. But for me, it's spiritual, and that can be, in my mind, a little less than definitive, if that makes sense. I'm fine. From my agnostic point of view, which is that I don't know what God is, I'm totally fine with that. But I know that faith can help me get through fear, and it works. I used to hope that it would work. Now I kind of know that it works. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Jen.
This little section of the book has a couple of lines that always really, really just kind of hit me. And one of them is the line where it talks about that by doing this and by becoming right-sized and doing what I'm asked to do by my higher power and not all of the ridiculous things that I think I'm supposed to be doing. But when I do that, my higher power enables me to match calamity with serenity. And I was the kind of drunk when I showed up here. One of the nicknames that was most commonly used for me was Hurricane Jen, because everyone that was in my life knew that I was Hurricane Jen. And their calamity could have been my middle name, because there was always going to be destruction. There was always going to be a mess. And I didn't know how to stop that, because I didn't know how to stop drinking without your help. And so being able to match calamity with serenity is such a huge promise to me. And it's something that I take, I find a lot of comfort in that line. And I also really relate to this idea of having to realize that it's actually a really strong place to come from, to say that I'm relying on something other than me instead of myself. I grew up in a family of origin where we were all sort of expected to sort out your own stuff, and don't let anybody see it if you're struggling, and don't tell anybody if you're not okay. And, you know, that was just the rule of, that was just the dynamic that we had. And so unlearning sort of the stigma around needing help, and learning how to say God is in charge, and that means I don't have to be in charge, and that is amazing. For me, that has been one of the big places when we're told that we commence to outgrow fear, that place of learning how to say, yeah, God's in charge and I'm not. And so I'm letting God be God. And this is me putting it into action, is one of the biggest sort of tangible and concrete places of growth that I can see in myself that started to happen. Being willing to say, I actually am going to open up that door a little bit and let God be God. Thanks.
Thank you both. All right, we're going to continue on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Jen?
I'll go ahead and get this one over with. So I've been really fortunate to have several women who have come into my life during the pandemic that I've gotten to sponsor. And every time we get to this part and have gone over this for the last several years, I just have to laugh, because this idea that many of us needed an overhauling here. You know, I came into this program in my late 20s, and I had one framed idea of what my sex life was supposed to be like. And it was really shaped by, you know, opinions that I had gotten from other people and things that I had absorbed from outside sources. And it took about 5 years in sobriety for me to realize that, like, none of that was actually what was my truth. And so the overhauling that I had to do in terms of, like, my sex conduct was drastic, like absolutely drastic. And for me, the biggest thing and something that my sponsor really has drilled into me about this part is that, especially the end of this paragraph, that I'm supposed to want to stay out of this controversy. And she has me flip this all into I statements and say, I do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Like, this is a big place for me to learn how to keep myself on my side of the street. Like, because I want to poke into everybody else's business and then think that I'm supposed to have some sort of opinion, like my version is the right way. And so learning how to get down to just my motives and only be thinking about my sex conduct as a function of, like, it's just a part of who I am as a person. And learning how to be concerned with that and how I am showing up and the person that I am bringing to the world, without trying to, like, railroad anybody else into behaving the way that I think they're supposed to, is, you know, for me, my going through this sex inventory made it really obvious for me to see that the ways that I was trying to make every, like, all of these other people in my life do whatever I thought that they were supposed to be doing. And then it spills into so many other areas of my life as well, because just across the board, I think I'm supposed to be in charge. And I think I'm supposed to be making decisions. And so I have to learn how to say, I don't actually want to be the arbiter of anyone's conduct, period. Because when I do that, I'm more worried about whatever's going on with them instead of how I'm showing up and either fulfilling or not fulfilling what my higher power wants me to do that day. So Scott, your turn.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, Jen. Boy, if I was scared of going through resentments and fears and everything else once I got to this sex thing, man, you talk about being scared and fearful. I sure was. And because I didn't know, this is the whole thing with me about sort of the concept of agnosticism. It's spread throughout AA for me, and I just didn't know how this inventory was supposed to work. So, and again, I think I said this in the fear section, I thought that the sex inventory, I was going to have to list out every dirty, nasty thing I ever did. Well, that's, and you know, and that's, I think that's a legitimate interpretation of what a sex inventory is. But what, and again, I have to benefit James, my intrepid sponsor at this time, with explaining that that we harm. This is beginning the inventory about harms. It's all about resentments, fears, and harms. And if I kind of understand that those are the three things that I focus on in the inventory, it makes sense if I really look seriously back in my life that one of the most tangible ways I've harmed people is through sexual relations. I can't even say it. I'm so nervous. And that's really true. So this is like the first step. And I think Bill's way of looking at this is that it's such an obvious way that most alcoholics and most people can pretty easily identify harms done through sex. But now the thing is what are we inventorying? Are we inventorying these sex acts that we've done? And I maintain, and my sponsor maintained that, no, that's not what I'm inventorying. I'm inventorying who I harmed and what did I do to harm them through this. I harmed my first partner because the expectation of monogamy was there and I lied. I was a cheat and lied about it. That's the harm that was done, and it's obvious. And I think that this is, I don't know if it was really a point that Bill thought about this as it was going through. Maybe Bill had so many sexual harms with Lois and who knows who else, that it was just a natural thing for him to do. I don't know. But what I did learn by the end of doing the inventory is that it sure got a whole lot easier segueing into the other ways that I harmed people, because using the harms that I did through sex were pretty obvious once we really started talking about them. Once again, I'm not sure if any of that makes any sense. I sure hope it does. And David, I'm going to turn the switch back over to you.
All righty then. We are going to continue on page 69. We reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Jen?
Scott, you want to go again?
Sure. You know, I got to tell you now this to me, I think this starts to show the whole benefit of doing this inventory business, is that once you start doing it, I realized how it just was not that hard. I literally spent a couple of years in fear of how hard this was, and it just wasn't. So much, David, of what you were just ringing just jumped off the page. It's all about how we hurt other people. And what I realize now is that I can talk about any of that. And I can talk about it from a sexual context, but I can talk about it through other harms too, through other relationship with friends, with that are non-sexual, interaction at work. You know, this stuff ends up kind of evolving into generic harms. And, you know, it's amazing to me that we learned through the inventory process that we actually can do something about it. I think that this paragraph just said, what can we do about it? There's always something we can do about it. And it usually involves doing the one thing that I don't like doing much, is talking. And I find now in AA, in recovery, I somehow have learned that talking about sex really makes sense, because I never talked about it before. It's just something that we did. But it sure does work a lot. Everything works a lot better if we talk about it. So there is stuff that we can do about it. And that's all I know today, which is not much.
Thanks, Scott.
So one of the things that was really helpful for me in this part was being told that in looking at my conduct and how I treated the people around me, that this was going to be one of the things that really showed me the patterns of how I showed up for life. And that has been so true. You know, I've done two full formal fourth and fifth steps in the time that I've been sober. And in both of them, during the sex conduct part, I've ended up just getting to a place where it's like, it's just the same stuff over and over again. It's me showing up the same way over and over again. And it's the same manipulativeness, and it's the same dishonesty, and it's the same. And when I can't see that on my own, but when I put it down on paper and I talk about it with my sponsor and she's like, that sounds really similar, then all of a sudden I have something. And, you know, not only does it feel less overwhelming, but now I have something that I can actually pray about. I'm told that I ask God to mold our ideals and help them live up to them. Like, then I get to go to my higher power and say, I need help learning how to not be a manipulative jerk. Like, because my default status is to be super manipulative. So help me figure out how to not do this. I have a concrete prayer that I can pray. And then when I do that, it becomes really simple. Like, I get to take it back to sort of how it was when I was first getting sober and I could never figure out what's the next right thing to do. Like, what's the next right thing to do? And it's like, well, don't take a drink, like keep breathing and don't take a drink. And, you know, so then as I'm figuring out, oh my gosh, well, what do I do? Like, well, Jennifer, look at your motives. And if there's any layer of manipulativeness happening, stop what you're doing, walk away, like talk to somebody about it, you know, just don't do the thing that's causing harm. And I really appreciated that sort of simplification of this part of the inventory. When I think about it as looking at my patterns of behavior and how I show up in the world and the way that I treat the people around me, it's a lot easier for me to treat it like the rest of my inventory and to really let it be part of the fact finding and fact facing process that's talked about a few pages before. So thanks.
Wonderful. Continuing on page 69, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I've lost track of.
Go for it, Scott.
I was just actually waiting on Jen to say something so spectacular and good. But this is I'll tell you, this section of the book, and I remember as I was reading it with James, this did something for me which tied step four directly into step nine by saying, of course, we're going to make amends. Of course, these are topics for possible amends for us to take in step nine. And also that our inventory can, not always, but can help drive step eight in making a list of those we'd harmed, because here we have an inventory of the harms that we've done. I still have to go back to the point that the true joy of the inventory for me was, and it's said many times, I think it was said in this paragraph too, it's getting it down on paper. Because if I look at it as it's written down, and the logic of actually writing it down is pretty cool, and it's cool in the fact that it does let me actually look at it. If I have all of that stuff swirling around in my head, I can't pin any of it down. I'm a math major, or at least I was in college. So I like to call myself a mathematician, which I'm not, but I know a little bit about math. And there's a thing called that I remember sort of not fondly, called simultaneous equations. And the only way to solve a simultaneous equation is to take part of it and pin it down and hold it and solve that part of the problem, because everything else is moving around too much. Inventory is exactly the same. If I don't write it down, I can't pin anything down to actually work on it, to come up with any kind of a solution. But if I do, and if I look at it just piece by piece, and again, instead of getting all mired down in all the details, just focus on who it is that I had these harmful relations with, and especially the ones where I was the cause. I think the final thing too is for that I had to remember that the inventory is not about all the bad things that I did. And somewhere in here, and I know I'm a little off topic here, I do get to go through some of the stuff that I did well. And I have to remember, I have to remind myself of that. I have to remind other people that I work on step work with that, you know, we've done, even in our alcoholic state, and even as we're pretty bad on a lot of things, there's still some good in there and it's worth looking at. All right, Jen, it's all you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, friend. Even just this first sentence of this part, that it says, we must be willing to grow toward whatever our ideal turns out to be. For me, that invitation to be willing to grow towards this ideal is something that I still just find so mind-boggling. I am the sort of person, I either want to think my way into a solution or I want to just immediately be good at the solution. I really am not interested in like whole practicing until I figure out how to do the thing. And so being told that growing towards my ideal means that I'm going to have, like, I will probably continue to make mistakes and then have to grow from those and learn in real time. For me is something that is just one of those continuous reminders that I get throughout this book as I go through, and whenever I go through it with a sponsor or with a woman that I sponsor, that my answer is never useful. Like, the way that I think I'm going to go about it is just not helpful. Because I'm going to grow here. I'm told that I have to be willing to grow towards this ideal. And when I ask God what I should do about each matter, I will talk often with my sponsor about what the, you know, like figuring out the right answer. What is the right answer? What is the right answer for X, Y, or Z problem? And so for me, I really appreciate the last line of this first paragraph, that the right answer will come if we want it. And that means that I just have to sit and be open. I don't have to figure it out. There's nothing for me to break open. The answer is going to come. And if I don't know what it is yet, then I'm supposed to do nothing and not act like I have all the answers. And my sponsor tells me all the time that as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's absolutely nothing that I need to figure out. There are lots of things that I am asked to do, but there's very little that I need to figure out. And for someone like me, whose entire approach to life is to figure it out on my own and make it work, being told to stop trying to force all of the puzzle pieces where I think they're supposed to belong is just radically new behavior. Like radical enough that it can really get me out of my own way. Thanks.
Awesome. We have come to the final paragraph of tonight's readings on page 70. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Jen?
Scott?
I love the fact that I love the fact that Bill in this particular section talks about so many other steps and talks about the earlier steps, and then the inventory is just the beginning. But that we've done a good job at this point. It's a really, really good place to be at the end of step four, partly because of how much we can fear actually doing it. But the benefit, you know, all of AA is about learning that, what I mean, he mentions it again, it's all about finding stuff outside of ourself. He says, you know, if you can't deal with this exactly, just find other people that you find a way to get out of yourself and all this. And I'm paraphrasing all of it, but we just heard it. And that's all about the solution. It's all about step two, coming to believe. And you know, it's the inventory process that helps us come to believe that there's a power out there greater than ourselves that can solve our problems, and that specifically can solve our problem around addiction and around the behaviors that we fell into over a very long period of time. I remember when I was finished with the inventory, I felt like I had the biggest sigh of relief. It was a sigh of relief that I had done that, but then also realizing the value of actually doing it, and thinking about how, what a benefit it would be. And of course I do that. I talk a lot about my fear and how hard it was, but you know, by the time you're done with it, it's just not hard. It really is not that hard when you get down to it. I keep saying, I hope that makes sense, but I don't really care if it makes sense or not. That's just what I think. All right, Jen, now it's you.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, friend. I always appreciate when I'm offered just sort of a blanket solution for things. Like I like just having an answer for something given to me. And my, you know, for me, when I look at this part, you know, thinking about places where I have had to apply this section of the book, in the time that I've been sober, I've had two really serious and significant relationships, and both of them ended very abruptly and very traumatically, and needed to end, like for the sake of my sobriety and lots of other things, like needed to end. But as a result of the dissolution of both of those relationships, I was not okay. And I'm so grateful that my sponsor was able to direct me here, because she told me, this is the trouble right now. So you're gonna throw yourself into working with others. Like, go find some new sponsees, go find some brand new women and take them to a meeting. Like, and it worked. Like, these are not just words. It worked. You know, I'm not saying I was like, everything was immediately better and I was fine and there was no more crying hysterically ever, like, because there was, but in the times that I got to spend really sitting down with another alcoholic and being present and trying to offer a little bit of the solution that I have been given, in those bits, I was, everything was fine. And I was okay. When I got to AA, my conception of a higher power was very limited and had a lot of, there were a lot of boundaries associated with my higher power. And for me, getting getting to this point and getting through this part of my step work is one of the things that I think about as having been very helpful in letting my God be as big as God needed to be. I don't have to get, I don't have to have like me sorted out and presentable and all of the right answers together to be able to do this work and get to know my higher power better. Like doing this work, I have a higher power that shows up in more significant ways and just is more present in my life. And so I have been taught that the whole point of me doing this, everything that I'm doing as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to have a spiritual experience that's going to relieve me of my alcoholism. And in this bit, this fourth step, I am really getting to get into it and get rid of some of the huge rocks that are standing in between me and my higher power that make that spiritual experience a little bit more possible. Yeah, the end. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. That was amazing. Let's see, what are we going to do now? We are going to do the seventh tradition. And that is right here. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. So if you missed the QR codes, there are links in the chat as well. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? Okay. It's too early to announce that this home group is planning on going back in person again, United Methodist Church on May 9th with a supper and a speaker. 6 p.m. potluck, 7 p.m. Chris W., past delegate from Carrollton, Virginia, is going to come be our guest. And we also intend to be hybrid. So we intend to stay on Zoom and we intend to start meeting in person on May 9th. Did I mention May 9th? Did I also mention it's too early to start announcing that? I'm not supposed to announce it this early. So I didn't. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us, or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. And Russell, would you read the last three paragraphs on page 164 if I put them up on the screen?
Sure.
Thank you.
Vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. Oh, I'm Russell. I'm an alcoholic, by the way. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for letting me read.
Thank you, sir. All right. This has been a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous here at the Simple Actions Group. You guys will get a chance to thank Jen and Scott again after the Lord's Prayer. Everyone has the ability to unmute, so I'd invite you to virtually circle up and hold hands and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Feel free to unmute and make it noisy, make it weird. It's going to be great. Our Father.
Father.
Who art in heaven.
Hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come.
Thy kingdom come.
Thy will be done.
Thy will be done.
On earth
as, it is in heaven.
Give us this day.
Give us this day our daily bread.
Give us our trespasses.
As we forgive, those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation.
But deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Whoop, whoop. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott.
Thank you so very much. You guys are the best. And David, was that date May 9th?